Hi, this is Mark DeVries, and welcome to Family Based Youth Ministry. This is the first tape in the series, and I'm excited about the chance to share with you some principles about doing youth ministry with sort of a different format, a different paradigm. As we get started, it would be helpful for you to know just a little bit about my background. I have been here at First Presbyterian in Nashville for the past 11 years. And when I came here, I came with the expectation that I wanted to do youth ministry when I grow up. And this has kind of been the place where I've been doing some of that. And I did youth ministry in Texas for about 6 years. And then when I was in seminary, led a Young Life Club for a couple years. So, and I do hope to do this probably for the next 20 or 30 years, God willing. I also, 3 years ago or so, wrote the book Family Based Youth Ministry. I am hoping that since that time I've learned a few things, and hopefully we'll be able to not only give sort of a theoretical framework, but can temper some of that with our experience here in Nashville and with other churches that I've talked to that have tried to implement a lot of these principles. The other piece you ought to know about me is that I have one wife, Susan, and three children. Adam is now 15 and has been in the youth group for now in his third year. And we have an 11-year-old daughter, Debbie, who will be who is just beginning adolescence, and then an 8-year daughter, Lee. Just in terms of format, about how we'll be going through the course. Much of what we'll be doing will be built on the text of family-based youth ministry. What I'll also be doing is adding in, here and there, different ideas or studies that came out since that time, just to help give a little bit fuller perspective. So with that, let's begin with just a little bit of history of how this whole journey for me got started. I remember a friend of mine named Jim, who I heard through the grapevine was leaving youth ministry. He'd been doing youth ministry for 9 years. He was probably one of the most successful guys at youth ministry I'd ever known. This fellow had 200 kids in small discipleship groups. He had the kind of creative programming that attracted kids from all over the city, and there was some real substance to what he was doing. It wasn't a flashy kind of flash-in-the-pan sort of thing. This was an impressive guy, and the way he was doing youth ministry was looked upon by everybody across the city as really effective and what we all wanted to be doing. So, of course, there's nothing shocking about people leaving youth ministry. But I was wondering why Jim was quitting. I had all kind of theories about the possibility. I wondered if he got a better offer somewhere else, or if he was going to become a teacher somewhere. Maybe he was going to create his own curriculum or his own video series or become a consultant. But of all of the possibilities I considered, the one that actually happened was a complete shock. He said, "I'm leaving youth ministry because I have this incredible sense of failure." I gotta tell you, I was stunned. This guy has a sense of failure, and yet he is the sort of paragon of youth ministry of anybody I'd ever known. Not only in my mind, but in plenty of other folks. But since Jim left youth ministry, his words have begun to make more and more sense to me. And I'm starting to see that his experience may actually be more the norm than the exception. In fact, the more that I talk to successful, I'm putting that in quotes, youth ministers, I'm seeing that almost every one of them suffers from a frustrating sense of failure. All have wondered more than once, am I really making any difference? Youth ministers know the anxiety of a juggler keeping a bat and a knife and a fire stick in the air all at the same time. They know the temporary insanity required in moving directly from suicide counseling to an egg roulette competition, and then into teaching a group of teenagers who aren't afraid to yawn in public. They know the nagging feeling of inadequacy that comes from being the run of the litter on the church staff, and they've heard the not-so-silent whisperings, is he or she ever going to become a real minister? Youth ministers know that they must always hold their enthusiasm about their teenagers' testimonies with a grain of salt. They've heard too much from too many who didn't follow through on their words. They know the frustration of being called disorganized because they forgot to bring the mustard for an otherwise perfect cookout. And they've fallen from the tightrope of listening to too much or too little criticism. But whether from the call of God or from temporary insanity, they and I love this work. And even when things are at their worst, many of us still can't think of anything else we'd rather do. Despite the nagging sense of frustration common to all of us, I've met very few youth workers who are out of ideas. Most are out of time and energy, patience and money. But ideas, we've got them by the truckload. Almost all of us know what we ought to be doing, but we just can't seem to keep all the youth ministry plates spinning at one time. We'd like to write great newsletter articles and prepare scintillating sermons and visit every kid in the youth group and boost attendance and work with parents and be available to handle crisis at the drop of a hat and have a model family and keep praying and studying on our own and visit the schools regularly, disciple our volunteer leaders, train great teachers, find or write curricula for Sunday school, build small groups, develop youth leadership, give stirring weekly reports, write letters to college students, give guitar lessons, send personal birthday cards to each young person, involve youth in mission on a monthly basis, plan great retreats and monthly fun trips, promote and fill all the trips, collect the money, fill the sanctuary with visible teenagers on Sunday morning, be the spiritual giant and fun-loving charisma machine that we are hired to be, and of course, relax all at the same time. But because we can't possibly keep all those plates spinning, youth ministry at its best involves a continual process of setting and adjusting priorities, deciding what we'll wring our hands about and what we will let slide. For most of us, ministry to or through parents of teenagers has simply been one of the many things on our to-do list that we've had to let slide. Jim Burns tells a story of a recent youth specialty seminar on the family and youth ministry. In preparation for the seminar, the leader polled a number of successful youth ministers across the country, and he asked, "What are you doing as a youth worker to help families succeed?" The overwhelming response was, "Well, I believe it ought to be happening, but I just haven't got around to doing it." The ironic truth is that youth leaders may have at their fingertips a resource for vastly expanding the scope of their ministry. But many of us see this resource as something that gets in the way of youth ministry, so we lay it aside. We're like the would-be handyman who attempts to move a boulder from his yard with a screwdriver, all the while complaining that a sledgehammer and the pickaxe keep getting in his way. He may or may not get the job done, but one thing is certain, he'll soon be exhausted and frustrated. So this course is designed for youth workers who are tired of quick fixes and easy answers. It's also designed for anyone responsible for a Christian ministry to teenagers. That could be pastors or youth committee members, parents, volunteer leaders, search committees looking for youth pastors. It's designed for parents also who want to understand the forces that most significantly impact their children's spiritual formation. Now, as the title of the course suggests, it's also a course about families. Now, let me tip my hand a little bit about what I'm saying when I talk about families. One of my working assumptions is that the contemporary crisis in youth ministry has little to do with our programming and everything to do with families. I believe our culture has put an incredible amount of weight on the nuclear family. Weight, I believe, it was never intended to bear alone. And so one of the secrets to a lasting ministry with teenagers is to find ways to undergird nuclear families with the rich support of the extended Christian family of the church. And then for these two formative families to work in concert in a way that they lead young people toward this goal of mature Christian adulthood. So this course will give a rationale for a real paradigm shift in our approach to working with teenagers. I want to challenge some of the assumptions underlying the way it's always been done, and give what I hope is an alternative and helpful approach. The beginning of the course will focus on what I see as the core deficiency in traditional youth ministry. The rest of the book is going to be dedicated to, the rest of the course will be dedicated to providing a realistic, informed understanding of what factors actually do lead young people to mature Christian adulthood. The goal of that is that if we can get a new perspective, we may have a clearer sense of how we can create a ministry that lasts for the long haul. So to that end, at the end of each section, I want to talk about some implications for ministry that come from that. It may be helpful for you to come up with some of your own. The idea is that these will be practical handles for applying these principles in each chapter. And in addition to that, in the final section, the final time we have together, I'll just walk through a collection of ideas, ways to apply these principles that I've picked up along the way. So this is a course about a new way of approaching youth ministry, a way that goes beyond the traditional traditional formulas that seem inherently to set youth leaders, to set us up for failure. But I got to tell you, this is not a shell answer man handbook. You're not going to find here the silver bullet that makes youth ministry a snap. Working with teenagers, it will never be easy. But what you will find, I hope, is an approach that can vastly expand our long-term effectiveness in any Christian ministry with teenagers. Let me now, as we move into talking about the crisis in youth ministry, I just want to offer a few thoughts. These are just some ideas that I picked up from some experts along the way. Let me share those with you just as grist for the mill as we get started. Here's Jay Kessler from a book called Energizing Your Teenager's Faith. Jay says, "It's disturbing how few Christian teenagers actually grow toward a more mature Christian faith. A national study by Search Institute found that in general, teenagers' church involvement and faith stagnate during high school." And then from Mark Center in his really groundbreaking book called The Coming Revolution in Youth Ministry, here's what he says. "The decade of the 1980s has drawn to a close, and the health of ministries to high school students in the United States is less than exciting. For the most part, ministries which employ youth specialists are locked within the white middle class, as church boards, urged by parents, attempt to ensure the passing of Christian values from one generation to the next. Parachurch agencies, which attempt to reach the entire student population with a single strategy, have ceased to grow." Then Kevin Huggins, in his book, Parenting Adolescents, says this, "I spent the last 17 years working with youth toward one principal goal, to see a personal faith in Jesus Christ become the controlling reality in kids' lives. According to some standards for measuring success, my 17-year investment may be viewed as relatively ineffective, although it is impossible to know what long-term impact my involvement in kids' lives really will be. At this time, I can point to only a small handful of kids and young adults with whom I have worked who bear the marks of being controlled by a personal faith in Christ. Though the personal rewards and joys of working with kids have been tremendous, these 17 years have made one thing clear. Personal faith in Christ cannot be mass-produced in adolescents' lives." And the final thought as we consider the crisis in youth ministry is from Doug Burley, past president of Young Life. "What the whole church must face, local congregations and parachurch ministries alike, is the enormity of the need. The facts speak for themselves. Only 15 to 20% of American teenagers are significantly involved in a church." So something's wrong. There is a crisis in traditional youth ministry. When I use the word traditional, it sounds like an oxymoron in a day when youth ministries pride themselves on being outrageous, wild, out of control, anything but traditional. But in the 1990s, such a clear pattern for youth ministry has emerged that no term describes it quite so well as traditional. What I'm calling traditional youth ministry has little to do with style or programming or personality. It has to do with the place of teenagers in the community of faith. Over the last century, churches and parachurch youth ministries alike have increasingly, often unwittingly, held to a single strategy that has become the most common characteristic of this model: the isolation of teenagers from the adult world, and particularly from the world of their own parents. This traditional model has its roots in the turn of the century with the rise of the Christian Endeavor movement, a church-based interdenominational program created especially for youth. Undergirded by a culture in which teenagers had frequent interaction with adults and with their own parents, the Christian Endeavor Society, and the church imitations that followed it, those were things like the Westminster Fellowship and the Epworth League and the Luther League, all of those seemed to flourish in that different kind of culture, one that was undergirded by a consistent involvement with significant adults. So using a Sunday night meeting format, these Christian Endeavor-type programs had discovered a creative model for reaching teenagers. When the popularity of the Sunday night Christian Endeavor format began to wane in the 1940s, a new style of youth ministry was launched. Young Life and Youth for Christ organizations, they hit on the strategy of reaching young people apart from the traditional church setting. Over the next few decades, these ministries expanded with explosive energy and reached scores of teenagers whom the institutional church seemed to be missing. In the last 25 years, groups like Youth Specialties have popularized the parachurch style of youth ministry by marketing their ideas to local churches. As a result, the face of youth ministry in the 90s has become increasingly creative, with a plethora of products designed to reach teenagers more effectively. But despite these external improvements, contemporary youth ministry is in crisis. I was speaking at a conference recently and asked to give a 30-second explanation of my seminar on family-based youth ministry. I reported that I have heard from many youth workers over the past 5 years what worked 5 or 10 years ago with teenagers is just not working anymore. I was not surprised to see the nods of agreement from the youth ministry professionals in the group. Later on that evening, one of the conference participants pulled me aside and made a telling remark. He said, I agree that things I did 5 years ago don't work anymore, but the real shock for me is that the things I did 5 months ago aren't working either. Let's talk about the definition of success. Many churches, it seems, measure their success based on how many mature Christian teenagers they can develop in their group. The stereotypical guitar-playing youth leader with a set of ideas, books, and a floppy Bible is no longer enough to attract the attention and enthusiasm of our youth. Long-term youth ministers who have followed the futures of their youth group members have begun to sense intuitively that something is wrong. Most veteran youth ministers I know have a busload of stories like my story about Jenny. As an average seventh grader, Jenny began visiting our youth group with a friend during church basketball season. Quite honestly, I expected that she would disappear after the 10-game season was over, but was I ever wrong? At some point during that first year, Jenny responded to the claims of Christ and became a model youth group member. She was a regular fixture at our Sunday morning, Sunday evening, and Wednesday night youth programs. She sat in the youth section in worship and even showed up when the missionary gave their slideshows. You know that one. India, land of contrast. Beep. Jenny came from a family in which the Christian faith was irrelevant at best. Her parents were supportive of her involvement in the church, but they made it clear that Jenny's spiritual priorities were not for them. But in spite of her family situation, we had reached Jenny. Whenever I had doubts about whether our ministry was having any impact, I would remind myself of Jenny and her amazing story. If anyone bore the marks of success in our ministry, it was she. Like most youth ministries, I had trouble evaluating the success of our program strictly on the basis of how large a crowd we could gather for youth meetings. But Jenny's story gave me something to hang on to. I could point to her when I needed assurance that I was actually doing something right. But as Jenny grew older, I became more enthusiastic, and I watched her precocious spiritual maturity develop. By the time she was a sophomore, she was a part of our student leadership team and someone I held up as a model for the younger members of our group. By anyone's standard, we had succeeded with Jenny. She was a mature Christian teenager, well ahead of most of her peers who grew up in Christian homes. Well, I left for seminary just before Jenny's junior year, and that same year she moved away as well. I lost touch with her for several years, so when one of our mutual friends mentioned seeing her, I was anxious to hear how she had grown. Well, interestingly enough, Jenny, our success story, is currently not active in any church. Apparently, after leaving our active youth ministry, she had not been impressed with any of the churches in her new city and chose not to be involved in any of them. She's now graduated from college and, after living with her boyfriend for a while, is on the fast track towards success in a career. And although she looks back on her youth group experience nostalgically, she has shown very little interest in pursuing her faith as an adult. Now, I haven't closed the book on Jenny's story. I continue to pray for her, trusting that God, who began the good work, is going to bring it to completion. But if Jenny's story has shown me one thing, it's that something was wrong with the way I was measuring success. The important aspect of Jenny's story is that our program actually succeeded in leading her to become a mature Christian teenager. But somehow we failed to place her on a track toward mature Christian adulthood. We were short-sighted, focusing on a short-term objective, the objective of keeping her involved and growing, but forgetting the long-term goal of laying a foundation that would last. There's little doubt that there are more successful youth ministries today than there were 20 years ago. If you talk to the folks who do, in my denomination, Montreat Youth Conference, they're moving to a sixth week, 1,500 kids each week. I'm guessing the FCA group would say they've got more kids coming to camp than ever before. I remember reading not long ago that Young Life had more kids going to camp than ever before. Kanakuk has got a very successful program going. There are more successful ministries to teenagers now than ever before. The truth is, we are getting better and better at producing mature Christian teenagers. We're getting more kids to come to our groups. More churches are spending money on youth ministry than ever before. There are more youth ministry professionals. Now, when Youth Specialties has a convention, there are sometimes up to 5,000 or more people that come to those conferences who are professionals in youth ministry or coming to be trained in youth ministry. In many ways, there are incredibly successful youth ministries in terms of how we're doing getting kids to come to meetings, in terms of leading kids to mature Christian adolescents. But here's the shocking statistics. There's research that suggests that since 1970, there's been no appreciable change in the proportion of adults who attend church services on any given time during the week. In other words, all of the incredible youth ministry that we're doing is not sending, even though we're increasing the quality and the number of kids involved, we're not increasing as they grow into adulthood. It's not shown there. The Lilly Foundation discovered that 40% of those who were confirmed in the 1950s and the early 60s, 40%, no longer belong to a church or attend church regularly that still consider themselves to be religious. What we've done is we've almost given an inoculation against ever catching this disease that comes to those who follow Jesus Christ. William Willimon and Robert Wilson described the crisis from the perspective of the United Methodist Church. They target their denomination's, quote, inability to retain young people after their maturity in the church as one of the chief causes of the decline in their denomination. A struggle in my own denomination, the Presbyterian Church USA, are symptomatic of the crisis in other mainline churches, all of which have had increasing difficulty hanging on to their youth once they become adults. Tom Gillespie, the president of Princeton Seminary, is pointing to the problem. The truth of the matter is that the chief cause of our membership decline is our inability over the past quarter of a century to translate our faith to our children. Put simply, we are unable to keep our children in the church when they become adults. As a result, we are not only a dwindling church, but an aging church as well. Most young people who disaffiliate with the church do so by the time they have become 16 years old. And research confirms that those youth who drop out of the church do so not when they leave for college, as is often assumed, but while they're still in high school. The crisis in youth ministry continues in spite of the exponential growth in the amount of money being spent on youth ministry, the number of professionals employed, and the number of teenagers that seem to be involved in a youth ministry, Bible studies, prayer groups of one kind or another. Successful youth ministries did not necessarily produce mature Christian adults, at least if we put successful in quotation marks. So if mature Christian adults is the goal, if training kids, setting them on a path toward mature Christian adulthood is the goal, we need to define what that means. I found a helpful chart that Duffy Robbins put together. A comparison of a childish faith and a mature adult faith. Let me compare these quickly. A childish faith, they have these sort of beliefs or assumptions. They would say that good Christians don't have pain or disappointment. Mature faith says God uses our pain and disappointment to make us better Christians. A childish faith says God helps those who help themselves. Mature faith says God helps those who admit their own helplessness. A childish faith says God wants us to be happy. A mature adult faith says God wants us to be made into the image of Jesus. In terms of that happy one, I remember reading Gomez. You remember Gomez on the Addams Family? He took Pugsley to school for the first time. And the principal said, Mr. Addams, I'm sure that Pugsley will be very happy here. And Gomez said, if I wanted him to be happy, I would have left him at home. I think we got to help kids understand that God's primary goal in their life is not to make them happy. Okay. Childish faith is a faith, is a belief that faith will help us always explain what God is doing. In other words, it's a belief that things always work out and we'll always be able to figure it out. A mature faith says faith helps us understand to stand under God's sovereignty, even when we have no idea what God is doing. Childish faith says the closer we get to God, the more perfect we get. A mature faith says the closer we get to God, the more we become aware of our own sinfulness. A childish faith says mature Christians have the answers. A mature faith says mature Christians can wrestle honestly with tough questions because we trust that God has all the answers. A childish faith says good Christians are always strong. A mature faith says our strength is in admitting our own weakness. A childish faith says we go to church because our friends are there, or we have great leaders, or we get something out of it. A mature faith says we go to church because we belong to the body of Christ. So this crisis we're talking about, this crisis that we are not leading our young people to mature Christian adulthood, cannot be addressed simply by making an increased effort in evangelism. The truth is many programs are going the front door. We're doing fine bringing them in. It's just that our back door is much larger. The crisis is that we're not leading our kids to mature Christian adulthood. If our youth programs are well attended, it's easy for youth leaders in churches to be satisfied with the attitude of childish faith. But the attitudes of spiritual maturity cannot be mass-produced. Remember the quote we read before we began this session. Cannot be mass-produced in teenagers' lives. These attitudes are created as young people move out of the comfortable bubble of the youth program and live out their faith through the challenging and often monotonous experiences of life. Jim Rayburn, the founder of Young Life, is frequently quoted as saying, "It's a sin to bore a kid." And I think I understand what he's saying, and I appreciate it. In other words, he's saying traditional structures of the church can often be obstacles rather than windows through which we see Christ. But I have to question whether keeping teenagers from ever being bored in their faith actually deprives them of opportunities to develop the discipline and perseverance needed to live the Christian life. I wonder if it might be more of a sin to suggest to young people that the Christian life is always fun and never boring. At least for me, it's precisely in those experiences that I might have described as a teenager as boring that my Christian character was often formed. Christian faith may begin on the mountaintop, as it often, in many ways, did with me. Certainly I had significant mountaintop experiences at Young Life camps growing up. But Christian character is not often formed on the mountaintop, but in the crucible of pain. So we shouldn't be shocked then to discover that the depth of faith maturity among Christians in our country pales in comparison to that of Christians who live out their faith in the shadow of persecution. Mature Christian adults then are those who no longer depend on the whistles and bells to motivate them to live out their faith. They've become proactive Christians, not reactive. When young people grow up to be reactive Christian adults, they're constantly waiting for someone or something to attract them, involve them, impress them, or I might even add, sell them, or as one person has written, market to them. A reactive Christian puts the responsibility for his or her spiritual life onto someone else. If our programs are training teenagers to be reactive, immature Christians, we can expect those young people eventually to become discouraged by the difficulty and the boredom of the Christian life. Could it be that the majority of our efforts in programming and publicity may, in fact, be moving teenagers away from rather than toward mature Christian adulthood? That's one of the dynamics that we saw in the story about Jenny. She had learned to react to a positive, exciting program. But when she left our program, we'd not given her the skills that she could proactively find a faith community herself. Most of us have seen that phenomenon over and over again with kids who graduate from an exciting youth program and go off to college. And they can't find anything that quite compares when they get off to college. Let's talk for just a little bit about numbers, because often discussions about numbers is the most controversial thing to bring up here. I remember the night. It was an incredible night. It seemed like young people were crammed in every corner of the room. We pulled out all the stops for this. We called it Five Sundays After Easter. Pulled out all the stops, and for the first time in my 6 years, we had over 100 young people together. Parents and church colleagues were patting me on the back, and I drove home satisfied as we finally had begun to get this program off the ground. But even as I breathed my satisfied sigh of self-congratulation, a vague uneasiness came over me. I began to wonder, what was Jesus feeling when the crowd gathered on Palm Sunday less than a week before his death? Was he thrilled by the attendance and their enthusiasm, or could he see through the crowd to what they were already in the process of becoming? I really began to ask myself, what do numbers really tell us anyway? Well, we may live in a culture that says that bigger is always better, but we serve a Lord who spoke of his kingdom in terms of a mustard seed, or a widow's mite, or a single lost sheep. I got to tell you, I love building a crowd as much as the next guy. It makes me feel good. It makes me look good. And because of what building a crowd does for me, I've often mistaken short-term success for long-term effectiveness. The short-sighted standard of success of traditional youth ministry reminds me of a great cartoon of Hagar the Horrible. Hagar and his men are in the Viking ships, rowing with all their might, but they're in complete confusion. After several frames, they finally begin to stroke together, and in the next to the last frame, Hagar is praising his men. Men, you finally got it. Now we're going somewhere. The final frame shows the enthusiastic group of soldiers rowing themselves off the edge of the earth. Ultimately, Hagar didn't know where he was leading his group, but he was really proud of the fact that he was making progress. And over the years, I've tried to find an image that describes where we are in youth ministry as well as that one, and I haven't found it. It does seem like we're pulling together more than ever. We're coordinating. We're getting more things involved. We're doing things more efficiently. But nobody has taken the time, or few people have taken the time, to look over their shoulder and see where this is leading us. As ironic as it may sound, my complaint is not that we're too concerned with numbers, but that we don't take numbers seriously enough. Avoidance of numbers certainly is not characteristic of the New Testament writers. Jesus knew exactly how many disciples he had. As a matter of fact, he often referred to them not as the disciples, but as the 12. Jesus sent out 70 disciples to minister. Over 4,000 people were fed miraculously at one event, 5,000 at another. Luke tells us that in the early days of the church, 3,000 were saved in a single day. Paul reminds us that Jesus appeared to over 500 after his resurrection. And the shepherd in Jesus' parable knew exactly the number of sheep he was charged to take care of. There's even a book in the Bible dedicated to numbers, right? It'd be fascinating to count the number of times. I'm reading through the book of Acts right now. It would be fascinating to count the number of times that word numbers appears, because the truth is the Bible is not ashamed of talking about numbers. And as biblical Christians, we don't need to be embarrassed about using numbers either. But frequently, youth workers and churches evaluate their success by the wrong numbers. I interviewed a pastor at a small church recently. I could tell by the tone in his voice that he felt like his youth ministry was a huge failure. He expressed his disappointment about their youth program, how hard it was to get teenagers to come, how few of their youth programs actually worked, and so on and so on. I asked about his numbers, and he explained that the group had 18 young people, and of that group, 15 were involved in the life of the church every week. The pastor, somewhat embarrassed, explained that most of their involvement was not with other youth, but with the adults in the church. He evaluated his youth ministry as unsuccessful because he couldn't get roomfuls of teenagers together for a youth meeting. On the same day, I visited a church in the same city that had over 10,000 members. I spoke to its youth minister as he was on his way out the door, and he only had time for me to ask him a few questions, so I asked about the numbers. How many young people do you have in your group? About 200, he responded, without an ounce of arrogance, but with an obvious air of success. And how many students are on your rolls? About 400. He hesitated and went on. We've decided that the best way to build our group is to have about twice as many on the rolls as we expect to see come. We spend our time with the ones that show up. It works. It works. Now, both these youth leaders were looking at the wrong numbers. The one who had 15 out of 18 involved weekly felt like a failure because he didn't have that many teens attending youth meetings. And a youth worker whose ministry was essentially ignoring about 200 students felt like a success, simply because of the size of the group that was coming. The ironic fact for most of us is that we spend a huge amount of energy getting more teens involved while ignoring most of the ones God has already given us. It's no coincidence that once Jesus chose the 12, the ones for whom he would be responsible, he didn't go out looking for more. Well, I want to talk about the search for new models. Mark Shinner, in his Comprehensive History of Youth Ministry in the United States, suggests that every 50 years or so, one or two major youth ministry agencies are recognized as the pacesetters for that era. Although the history does not fall out in exactly 50-year stages, Center traces a definite pattern that can be helpful in understanding the current state of youth ministry in the United States. He says that beginning in the 1790s, there was the beginning of the Sunday school movement. And that began in England. Of course, you probably recall from your history that that was not like the Sunday schools we know it today. And I often tell folks, if anybody comes up to you and says, we've always done it this way, we've always had Sunday school, you can say, no, we just started that a couple hundred years ago. Jesus didn't have Sunday school, Paul didn't, and neither did Augustine or Erasmus or any of those other people. Up until the 1790s, it was a ministry to street children. A very radical thing. They were teaching them not only the Bible, but how to read and basic problem solving, math. And the church was very resistant to that idea. Why? Because it was on the Sabbath, and it was not something traditionally that the church had been doing. If I had to come up with a text for that period of youth ministry, I would use Matthew 28, the end of that chapter, where Jesus gives the Great Commission. Go into all the world and make disciples. And that's what, there was a sense of being called into the streets to reach these children. Well, then in the 1830s or the 1850s, as the Industrial Revolution is in full swing, young men particularly are moving to the cities, and a ministry is created just for them, the Young Men's Christian Association. And at that point, that ministry evolves there with young men, discipling those young men, giving them a place to stay. It was a radically different move. If I had a text for that, it would probably be the Good Samaritan. Then in the 1890s, the Society for Christian Endeavor that we've already talked about comes on the scene. That's where we get the Sunday night youth group. Again, if somebody ever says, hey, we've always had Sunday night youth group, you can say, no, we only started that 100 or so years ago, Society for Christian Endeavor. The way the Society for Christian Endeavor was structured was that each student would make a pledge to endeavor to live like a Christian. And there were certain things that they would pledge to do. If I had a text for the Society for Christian Endeavor, it would be from Joshua, choose this day whom you will serve. And then in the 1940s, there was Young Life and Youth for Christ coming on the scene. Whole new model. Youth for Christ had their first rally, the big rally, and Billy Graham was the preacher for that rally. Young Life was not rallies, but in homes, having club meetings in homes. Both of these, I would say, were built primarily, at least philosophically, around the text John 10:10. I came that you might have life and have it more abundantly. Certainly, my experience in Young Life growing up was that this whole following Christ thing was fun. It was engaging. It was enjoyable. It was a sin to be bored as a kid at that time. Well, here we are at the 1990s. Center doesn't have a whole lot of suggestions for us. It is interesting that he does not even mention the need for a connection with families. That's not even on the scene when Center's book comes out. I want to suggest, just throw out, that perhaps the new model for youth ministry for the next 50 years is going to have something to do with engaging the both nuclear families and the extended family of the church. And if there was a text for that, it'd be Deuteronomy 6, the Shema, where it says, impress these things on your children. Talk about them on the way. And it tells about as you go to bed at night, when you get up in the morning, etc., etc. And I would look at Hebrews 12, 1 and 2, the great cloud of witnesses. And we'll talk about this as we talk about the crisis in youth ministry some more. So not only does Center identify approximately a 50-year pattern between stages, he also documents a clear pattern within each stage. Each of these movements was carried along at first, the first 20 or 30 years, by a wave of excitement and constant innovation. By the 30-year point, each began to become institutionalized, its strategies codified into planning manuals, and many of its methods adopted by the church. By the end of the 50 years, the once cutting-edge ministries had become tame institutions, and the stage was set for a new movement to begin. Now, if Center's right, and I think he is, the stage is now set for a new movement to lead the way in the next youth ministry cycle. The shape of youth ministry is in transition across the United States. The Young Life, Youth for Christ ministries have both had significant turnover in their senior leadership. And although teens in some locations are attending these groups in record numbers, these parachurch groups have themselves become institutions whose growth has in some ways leveled off. At least Center says, a study of history suggests that we're about to see a fundamental departure from what we have understood to be youth ministry during the closing decades of the 20th century. Though most parachurch agencies and denominational programs will continue to exist and make contributions, their strategies have become flawed. A new movement is about to appear and may already be emerging. Mike Iaconelli, in a recent address to the National Youth Workers Convention, seemed to be suggesting the same thing. He said, kids today are unlike any other generation of kids we've ever had to work with in youth ministry. All the techniques, all the strategies, all the philosophies that we're using and grew up with don't work anymore. But if we don't wake up in the church and begin to radically alter and change what it is we're doing with kids, we've lost them. We need some radical new models for ministering to kids, and we better wake up to the fact that if we don't, we've lost these kids. Don Griggs, responding to the 1990 findings of the Search Institute report, has suggested new models must be developed for Christian education, models that focus on adults and senior highs that are offered at times other than Sunday morning. Traditional youth ministry in the church today may have become little more than a hodgepodge of the structural remains of youth ministry dinosaurs. Okay, that's a bit of an overstatement. But it is clear that, just consider this, every church has a youth Sunday school program. Why? Well, because every church has always had a youth Sunday school program. Almost every church has a Sunday night program. Why? Because we can't seem to let go of the Christian Endeavor structure that worked so well at the beginning of the 1900s. Nearly every church youth ministry has developed a fragmented collection of parachurch resources and ideas about discipleship groups, special events, mission trips, and so on. The next stage of youth ministry will not be found by returning to any of these old structures. The answer to the crisis in youth ministry does not lie in infusing our tired structures with life. We need an entirely new way of looking at youth ministry. As I think about the books that have been written on youth ministry in the last few years, each of them suggests a piece. But very few of them, all of them seem to work independent of each other. For example, there are books about developing student leadership, which work very well if you're going to only do student leadership and focus on that. Or books that talk about missions, and if you're only going to really focus on missions, or youth choirs. But the idea is we've got to find a model that can undergird all of those different ways of doing youth ministry without assuming that any one of them is the way of doing youth ministry. I want to say a bit more about the unique crisis facing youth ministry today, but I think before we get to that, we're nearing the end of the tape, so I'm going to have you turn this side over, and we'll begin on the other side. At this point, just fast forward to the end and turn your tape over to side B.